Philip Ryder Davis. This recording is part of the oral history project carried out by the Suffolk Horse Society in 2013 with advice from Cambridge Community Heritage and a generous grant from the Heritage Lotteries Fund. In the recording you will hear the voice of Philip Ryder Davis describing his memories of the Suffolk Punch Heavy Horse. Philip is a retired equine veterinary surgeon and Suffolk Punch enthusiast. The recording was made by Leslie Dolphin, the well-known presenter from BBC Radio Suffolk. The date of the recording was the 5th of September 2013, and it was carried out at BBC Radio Suffolk. The duration of the second recording is about 32 minutes.
Guest with us on the programme today has been involved with horses for most of his life. For many years, Philip Ryder Davis headed his own veterinary practice here in Suffolk, originally qualified as a doctor, but then decided he preferred working with animals. He started out working in circuses and zoos before moving to Suffolk to set up his practice. He took over the Suffolk Horse Society and the Redpoll Cattle Society. He's also become the Suffolk Punch Trust chairman when that formed in 2002, has been a vet for the Shire Horses and helped found the Rare Breed Survival Trust. So that's quite a long list, isn't it? Lovely to see you again, because I know you've been before. How's things? Because you're retired now, aren't you?
Theoretically. Yeah, I haven't quite got to grips with that, really.
When did you officially retire?
About 3 years ago, I suppose. I retired for an afternoon.
Do you still go back in?
I do a bit, yeah.
Is your son ask you back in, or is he trying to kick you out?
No, he does ask me.
Because he runs the practice as well, doesn't he? Which is lovely. That's a real heritage thing, though, isn't it? Aren't you proud to see it?
I am, yes. It's lovely, you know. I really enjoy it.
Tell me about your involvement with the Suffolk Horses as well, because the Suffolk Horse Society and being chairman of the work there. Tell me how that all came about.
I came to Suffolk just about 40 years ago, I suppose. And the Suffolk Horse at the time was, I suppose, at its lowest ebb. It was run by very elderly people. The secretary was in his 80s, and it was run extremely well, but of course everything was, you know, down to a very low number of everything, really. And the secretary was going to retire, and somehow, I can't remember how, I became secretary.
Were you aware at that time just how threatened? Because as we've heard, you and we'll talk about it, you hitching around the place as a youngster, taking photos of rare animals and things. So you were obviously aware that some animals were in a bit of a plight. When did you realise the plight of the Suffolk Horse?
Oh, well, when I came here, I was vet to the prison stud, you see, at Horsey Bay. So I walked into that, if you like. So I was immediately involved. So that's when I realised how things were. But actually, while it was at a low ebb, it was very well run. I think that's very important, really.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about that first time. Was that your first meeting with Suffolk Punches?
Well, on my honeymoon, we came to Suffolk and went to look at Suffolk Punches, actually.
Did you? I don't know how you dare admit that.
there was a certain amount of grumbling about it, I think, as far as I can remember. So I had seen them before, and of course I'd seen them at shows.
But you've learned lots about them, haven't you? Because they are a special breed all of their own, aren't they, really?
Well, they are very, very special. I mean, they've got the most extraordinary history. It's the oldest breed of its type in the world to sort of look like it always has done, if you like. All the other breeds have changed, and quite often in the relatively recent past. So it is like it has been for probably 200 or 300 years. And, of course, its history is extraordinary. Every living Suffolk can trace back its lineage to 1768, to a stallion in Ufford. And there's nothing else like that. It's actually the longest written, unbroken pedigree of any breed.
And the Suffolk Punch horse itself, is it different to look after in comparison with other horses? I mean, you're an expert in horses, aren't you, really? So and when you work at the Suffolk Punch Trust and you know you've got a mare in foal, for example, are the differences between that horse and other horses, or are they basically the same?
No, they're all horses.
Yeah.
I mean, the one big advantage, I've got to be careful what I say, because I work for the Shire Horse Society, but, you know, they have this tremendous amount of hair on their legs. As long as nobody's listening from the Shire Horse Society,
you have to be particularly careful. Yeah,
the hair really isn't such a good thing, because if it gets wet and stays wet, then you get skin problems. And of course, the Suffolk doesn't have that. Other than that, there's no real great difference. The only other thing is these very big horses do get arthritic problems, which smaller horses don't, on the whole, because of the concussion.
What's a perfect Suffolk Punch look like?
Well, I suppose I'd have to say the stallion we've got at the Trust, Achilles. I mean, he really is absolutely magnificent. And he's very big. It's just this extraordinary shape, this very big body on what looked like short legs, which is a bit of an optical illusion. But he just looks absolutely magnificent. And, of course, they're quite different. The Shires, with all the hair, they're very showy and rather sort of flash, really. But the Suffolk doesn't have that. It's something more basic, I think.
And in your time here in Suffolk, did you get the chance, because these days most of the horsemen have disappeared, haven't they, and the people who use them on the farms, but did you get to meet any of those people when you first came to Suffolk?
Oh, yes, I worked for them, really. I mean, the people who stopped this breed becoming extinct, there was really half a dozen, and I worked for all of them. I mean, extraordinary characters like Charlie Saunders of Hoxham near Diss. I mean, he was just an extraordinary man. And he had about, at one point, he had 30 Suffolk geldings there, all of whom were looked after by Jenny Caldwell, who worked for him. And she did it all on her own. And she was another extraordinary character. Actually, Alf Adams and Felix Doe, he was extraordinary. They all were, really.
Mm. And so Jenny, I had never heard of a horse woman as opposed to a horse...
Oh, well, she was she was absolutely wonderful. She was probably about 60, I suppose, when I started working for her. And Charlie was 80. And they were extraordinary together. They used to fall out and have the most massive rows. And once they had a row, they wouldn't speak to each other, which made life quite difficult.
So really. Did they talk through you?
Oh, well, actually, this is really true. Charlie was standing on my right, Jenny on my left, and I said we ought to do something. And Charlie said, I own these horses, I'll decide what we do. And Jenny said, tell the old something, I'll decide, I'll look after them. You tell him. But they were telling me to tell the other one, but they're only a yard. And I was, you know, quite young, and what? I was standing there thinking,
oh. Oh, dear, what do I do? So did they work the horses at the time?
Oh, well, they what they did was they showed teams of four-horse teams, and Jenny broke them all in and did that, and they were very, very big horses. She used to drive a six-horse team at the Royal Lancashire Show, and in fact, one year she drove eight very big Suffolk horses, and she did it on her own.
Are they easy to work like that?
No. I mean, you really have to understand what you're doing. You have to make quite sure you're the master. No, it isn't easy. It's actually really quite difficult. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, they've essentially got a good temperament.
I love some of the stories of the older Suffolk horsemen, because didn't they used to have sort of, apart from anything else, they'd have secret little oils, and yeah. They'd have secrets that they wouldn't tell people, didn't they?
Yes,
did you ever manage to wheedle those out?
Yes.
I thought you might.
They had little notebooks. And that was your passport to a job, really, because in that you had recipes. Because at that time, vets didn't really do much in the way of medicine. There were no antibiotics. Vets really did surgery more than anything else. So the horsemen treated their horses themselves with these little books. And they were very secret, and they hung on to them all the time. But the funny thing was, if you did find them and look at them, they were all the same.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they thought they were keeping their own secrets from each other, but in fact they all knew pretty much the same things.
And very recently I've found a printed book that was on sale, and that is, it's all in there. So they must have bought that book somewhere. You know, I've never seen it before a month ago.
It's really interesting. How did you get involved with the Suffolk Punch Trust when the trust was formed?
Well, in 2002, the prison service decided to stop their farming activities. And, of course, the big problem, this was the biggest of the 35 prison farms, and the big problem was the Suffolk Stud. And so the prison service decided they would like to keep the stud together somehow or other. So they offered it to the Suffolk Horse Society, who felt they couldn't take it on. So four or five of us, I suppose, had the bright idea of starting the Suffolk Punch Trust to try and save it.
Was that important, do you think, from your point of view, as someone involved in horses and rare breeds as well?
Well, I think it's intensely important because this stud has been in unbroken existence for 250 years. Now, that is absolutely extraordinary. But these big studs, you see, the last one to get sold was Sir Robert Gooch's near Lowestoft. And the problem was, you'd like to think those horses go off and start new studs, because that was about the same size as the Halsey Bay stud. In fact, it didn't. Only about two of those horses ever really appeared again. They just seemed to disappear. But the other thing is, when you get a breeding group that's been in existence for a long time, then you get a stamp, you know, a type, if you like. And I think the Halsey Bay type was very good.
And I mean, you've worked really hard at it. It wasn't easy, was it? You wanted to form this trust. You wanted to have a visitor centre, make it something that people visited. Yeah. So you had this vision, but you've had to work really hard to get there, haven't you?
Well, yes, yeah. And it is very difficult to run it because clearly it's very expensive to run a thing like that. And, I mean, it's an educational charity as well. And we have visits by school children from disadvantaged areas who don't pay. As a business plan, you'd be feeding a great big animal nobody particularly wants and having children for nothing.
And I guess you've spent quite a lot of your time out there just physically. Have you helped put the fence posts in and all those things?
No, I haven't done that.
You haven't done that. Just tell me what's there nowadays. So just in case people haven't been, it's a lovely area to visit, isn't it, with the kids?
Yeah, well, it's a lovely site. And what is there now is we've got red pole cattle, all the Suffolk breeds, large black pigs, the oldest registered flock of Suffolk sheep in the world. The two Suffolk breeds of poultry, Ixworth fowls and Silver Appleyard ducks. So we've got all those. We've got a garden which is now well on its way to being set up, and that'll be stocked with horticultural varieties of plants all bred in Suffolk. And we have a list of about 130 of them.
Really?
And they go from orchard trees, we've got 17 in at the minute, down through shrubs, which were, a lot of those were invented by Knockcutts in the 1930s, and then down to perennial plants. So,
fantastic.
And actually, that already, even though it's in its early stages, it does look lovely. And then we've got a very big museum of smaller things, all of which relate to rural life in Suffolk, but sort of around Suffolk horses. And then we've got another big hall with 65 horse-drawn vehicles and implements in it, but they're all in working order.
What's your vision? What would you, in 20 years, what would you like to see there?
Well, that we're still there.
That you still, I knew you were going to say that.
I mean, we sort of reached what we want to do. We've just got to develop it in terms of visitor numbers.
And you have to make it pay, I suppose, as well.
It is building up. It's becoming somewhere where people would go, I think.
And you've got so many people who support it in terms of volunteering, fundraising. That's what you need, isn't it?
Yeah, we do need a lot more volunteers. That's for certain. We have paid staff, but we do need a lot more volunteers in everything we do, really.
So what sort of things? Anything?
Well, there's the animals, then there's the admin side, there's guides, you know, all those sort of things.
So someone who's got a few hours to spare. I mean, it's a lovely place to come to, isn't it?
It is. It is lovely. You know, I just love going down there.
Do you spend far too much time down there?
Not as much as I'd like to do, but I do quite a lot of stuff, you know, when I'm not down there, really.
And because you've had, is it three foals this year? How many foals have you had?
Well, yes, we did sell a mare that was in foal. So she went and she's had a foal for somebody else. And then we did lose a foal when it was born.
That's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because horses, I was saying this when Tracy came in, who's a stud groom there, they're just not, you're just not well made, are they, horses? You just can't predict how things are going to go.
God made them all wrong, really, to be honest.
But you've done all right over the years, haven't you?
Oh, yes. I mean, the breeding, you know, the breeding is very good. We use modern breeding methods with scanners and those sort of things, which you really have to do. I suppose, actually, when I came here, I came from I think it was the biggest thoroughbred stud, racehorse stud, in the country with 200 mares. So I'd been doing that kind of thing. Actually, it was before scanners, but it's principally the same. So I came here and started doing that at the stud at Housley. And it does make a very big difference to how many foals you get out of your mares.
So the technology is really important, is it? Yeah. It's fascinating. And that must have changed quite a lot since you first started.
I started, I mean, without going into too much detail, you feel a mare's ovaries and you feel them change and you decide the day that you put the stallion on the mare. And so I did it, well, like everybody else did it at the time, by just feeling them. When the scanner came along, and it does the same thing in many ways, except it actually measures the changes. It's a computerised thing. So it's the same thing, really, but it's a bit more accurate.
God, I'm glad I'm not a horse. That's all I can say.
I remember my son, who's never worked without a scanner, I put my hand in the mare and said, this is a follicle, which is what you feel on the ovary, 3.5 centimetres. And you could see him looking at me pityingly, you know. He put the scanner in and measured it. Oh, it is 3.5.
You were right. Yeah, they just shows. When did you come to Suffolk?
About 40 years ago.
Okay. But before that, where did you grow up?
I was born in Wales, grew up in Wales. And it was an idyllic time for children, really, the 1940s. I had a pony, you could go anywhere you like. My mother just disappeared every day, appeared in time for a meal in the evening. So, you know, for children then, I think it was wonderful.
So horses, from the minute you could ride rather than walk, probably, was it?
Yeah.
And did you know then that's what you wanted to? Animals? You obviously didn't as you went into medical practice, because all your family were doctors, was that right?
Well, 12 members of my immediate family were doctors. They'd all been to the same medical school that I went to, so I grew up thinking that everybody did, really, you know, that everybody was a doctor.
Nothing else to do, yeah.
So went to medical school, and actually at that time in London there were still a lot of working horses, and I spent more time than I should have done with them, and there were a lot of them. Actually, rather oddly, the London Cart Horse Parade and the Vanner Parade, they were welfare parades in Regent's Park, one on Easter Monday, one on Whit Monday. All the London, well, most of the big London horsemen and the big companies of the horses sent their horses to these two parades. Now, I went to those, you know, every single year. In the end, they amalgamated because the Vanners were the lighter working horses, so you had one parade. And in the end, Ken Livingstone banned it from London after about 130 years for some reason of his own.
How bizarre, what a shame.
But I never missed them, and it was then moved down to the South of England Showground in Ardingly in Sussex, which, and everybody said that'd be the end of it. But actually, it's doing extremely well. And rather oddly, I've ended up as vet to it. So it's a bit of a full circle, really.
That's brilliant. So you just used to go because you loved it, didn't you, at that point?
And I love it now, actually.
And so there were still lots of, was it, have been drays and pubs?
Oh, yeah, brewers, all sorts of people. There were carriers, there were still railway horses. There were the lighter horses, there were quite a lot of them. There were rag and bone men, Gilby's Gin had horses, so there were a lot.
So when did you, how was your family when you went home and said, look, I'm going to be a vet, not a doctor?
Well, the big problem was, I mean, I should have changed while I was a medical student. The only problem was, I reckon the medical student in the 1960s was the highest level of hedonism known to man, really, so, you know, it was very difficult to stop. And then I thought I'd better finish it anyway, which I did. And at that point I thought, well, I think it's time now I do what I want. So I actually got a job with Whitbread's Brewery, who still had 30 working shires in the city. And that was absolutely fantastic. I really enjoyed that. So I suppose it all started then, really.
So did you learn because it isn't, I mean, people and horses aren't quite the same, are they, in terms of medicine, although probably not that different. Did you have to do different training to become a vet?
Yeah.
Because that's quite a long course as well, isn't it? Or could you start halfway through because you'd...
Well, I could have done if I'd gone to one veterinary school, but I think there would have been a mistake because they are completely different, really. So also, I got married, and my wife said, if you don't become a vet, you'll never be happy. I'm not sure I ever have been, really. But
I think you probably have.
Anyway, also I had the slight problem that she worked. I went to veterinary school and I didn't have a grant. So actually the veterinary school were very good to me. They employed me to do all sorts of things. So they were very good. My wife worked and has never stopped pointing out that, you know, I remind you, I put you through college. So I've had that to live with.
Well, it's a steps, you're right. That's all I can say.
Anyway, I qualified. Actually, my first job was in Bristol Zoo. And the first animal I ever treated was a black male African rhinoceros, which, you know, wasn't quite so easy. But obviously the primates are, you know, similar to humans. I mean, they're really very different in many ways as well.
Did you meet Johnny Morris?
I never did meet Johnny Morris, no. But I then went to London Zoo after Bristol Zoo and took Guy the Gorilla's teeth out.
I guess he was asleep at the time.
Yeah.
So that's quite complicated, isn't it? So you have to learn all sorts about anaesthetics as well as amazing facts about animals. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it was, of course, that was in the very early stages of all this as well. Actually, after London Zoo, I went to a horse practice in Lincolnshire, but I did zoo and circus stuff from there and over a large part of the country. So I drove about all over the place with a dart gun in my car. And actually, you had to sort of, you don't say make it up exactly, but so much of it had never been done before at that point. So you just had to
estimate.
Yes. And, of course, you didn't have any time either. And actually, that was a very good thing, because if you drove 100 miles somewhere, by the time you got there, you should already have been somewhere else. So there wasn't time to stand about thinking, you know, shall I do this?
How heavy is it?
Or shall I do that? You know, you really had to just do something and, you know, hope it was right. And luckily it was, really, I suppose.
Any particularly scary moments?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, you have to tell me then.
Well, I mean, there were several, I suppose. I mean, really, you know, you take great care not to be eaten by a lion, don't you? You know, it's actually more dangerous working with horses, really, I suppose. But there were things like I had to go and put two lions into crates that were going to be moved somewhere. And they belonged to a company which had three big zoos, but they actually were animal dealers as well. When I got there, the two lions were in an office, which was a bit strange. There were no secretaries in the office, I have to tell you. And it was in a building with a corridor down to it. Well, normally, you see, with a dart gun, you shot it between the bars. or in a very big enclosed, you had a Land Rover or something. But this one, the problem was that there was an office door, and they were in the office, but there was a little glass window. So the only way you could shoot them with a dart gun was to have the door opened a bit by somebody you really trusted to hang onto the door handle, because clearly you didn't really want
you
the door...
You didn't want them to run apart right the really, else, no. Didn't they?
And I then found out, or realised, I didn't really have enough knockout drops for two. So, but it was 150 miles or something, so I can't go back. So I split it into two. And the other thing was I couldn't miss with the dart either, because, I mean, clearly that would have been a bit of a problem. So my right-hand man opened the door holding the handle, and I told him, you held it, hung onto the handle. So I shot at the first one, which took some time because they were actually flying around this great big room. It was a big room.
They would be a bit confused, wouldn't they, being in an office?
So in the end, I shot it and I got one. And it actually went down near the door, as it so happened. And the problem then was the crate wouldn't go into the office building. So the crate was now outside the office building with a Z-shaped corridor and me with a rope. I told my right-hand man to go because if he got eaten, you know, I thought that would have been a bit of a problem. And with a broom and a noose, I got the noose round the lion's hind legs, which mercifully was a bit pointing towards me. I then shouted at the men outside to pull the rope, which they did, except the lion was grabbing hold of the doorpost and everything else. So I was with the broom, because it wasn't all that. And it was anaesthetised enough, I suppose, but not all that.
But not sound asleep.
And with the broom, I was pushing his paws off everything he got hold of. And then, of course, I still had the other one.
But which actually, was still awake, was it, the other one at that
point? Oh, yeah.
Point?
So then I shot the second one, and actually the same thing, it went right down by the door as it opened. So I got away with it, but it was a bit...
It's making my hands sweat just thinking about it. I can't decide whether horses have a good kick, don't they? So they can be quite scary as well.
Well, it is more dangerous, really, because you have to handle them. You know, you take great care with these more dangerous things, really.
But you must have learnt your own horse whispering techniques, really, over time.
Well, I think, I'm not sure about that, but there is, I think there's something in you, really, I suppose, you know. I think some people, you know, can do it and some people can't, I suppose. There's something in you which enables you to sort of deal with them.
But you, and you've grown up with them, so you're not frightened of horses, are you? And they would know if you were, wouldn't they?
I did have a, I suppose, actually my son is the same. You know, we're recognised as being able to deal with difficult horses now. That doesn't mean you're not afraid of them, because they can be very, very dangerous. But I think it means you can cope with it, you know, and deal with it.
What's the technique? You're not meant... no animals should you look in the eye, should you? And horses are the same, aren't they?
You don't get all that much chance where you look, really, with some of them, you know. But I think you just, you know, you realise what you can do and you can't do, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So circuses stopped being happening, didn't they? And zoos didn't give you enough work, and that was how you came here?
What happened was there were an awful lot of smaller zoos. There were over 200, you see, at that time, and there were three big circuses. Well, they went for economic reasons, really. So everything changed. And actually, it was feast or famine as well. I mean, that was another problem. You know, it wasn't a very steady living. And it was very exciting, and I loved it. But, you know... I was married, had children, so I thought it was time to get a proper job somewhere.
And so, how come here? I mean, you'd already been for your honeymoon, so you obviously knew of Suffolk.
Well, at the time, there were more vets than there are jobs. It's the opposite now. So getting a job wasn't all that easy, and there was a job here, so I came here.
And did you start for someone else at that point and then set up your own business?
Yes, for a short time. And then my then-partner, Dick Smith, and I bought that practice, and then we sort of developed it from there.
And did you set out to be sort of, because you've worked in the equine world for a long time, haven't you?
Well, there were very few horses in the practice at that time, and then it sort of, the whole thing built up, you know, quite a lot.
Tell me about your rescuing of rare breeds. Because this is when you were younger as well, wasn't it?
Well, when I was a medical student, I became aware that a lot of British farm animals were becoming extinct, and an awful lot of them were down to a single breeding unit, and no one really was thinking about it. And I actually hitchhiked around Great Britain with a camera and took photographs of all these breeds, which were then very, very rare. There was like one flock of Shropshire sheep, one flock of Cotswold sheep and so forth. Three became extinct after I photographed them. I've still got the photographs. And what happened was I wrote an article about it in the Field magazine, which was then different to as it is now. And actually that was the first published thing about rare breeds. And it got people thinking. And really, I suppose that is how the Rare Breed Survival Trust started, because it was the kind of thing that got everybody thinking about it.
And I mean, we've got Balham and other places now where they actually do breed rare breeds on purpose, don't they? But yeah, it's easy for us to take it for granted now, though, isn't it? You obviously saw some of these animals before they disappeared.
Yeah, well, three went, and an awful lot of the others were down, as I say, to a single unit.
And the Redpoll Cattle Society, you took that on at the same time as the Suffolk Horse Society.
Funny enough, you see, the Redpolls never came into what I did when I was doing the rare breed thing, because of course at that time they were not rare; they were a very big commercial breed. They became rare later.
What was it that was their downfall?
Well, the introduction of the Friesian, you know, the black and white
cow
which produces gallons of milk.
Yeah.
And of course the big continental beef breeds. So that's what happened. But actually, they're now no longer rare because people are now realising they produce meat in particular at a very low cost, and they're no longer rare. You know, they're back on a very marked increase as well.
Because there was that, was it Codnam where there was the herd of
Miss Wiles, lovely.
So you can dairy and beef them, can you?
Well, that's what they were. They were a dual purpose thing. So you milk them and you produce beef. Now, the milking side, actually, funny enough, that's building up a little bit. But that when I took over the society, there were a lot of dairy herds. Well, I say a lot, I mean, you know, in relation to the whole breed, there were quite a lot of them.
You must have seen a huge change in farming of animals as well. So disappearance of horses, a lot of cattle in this part of the world as well.
Well, I spent my childhood on a farm in Northampton. I had a great uncle who, they didn't have children. I spent all my summers there. And, you know, you go back to that, there was a dairy herd, a beef herd, there were sheep, all sorts of things, crops were grown. It was such a real mixed farming economy, really. And it was lovely to grow up in it. Of course, it, you know, gradually became sort of industrialised, really. But in those days, it was just a huge pleasure to be on a farm.
And the Shah horses, because you look after those as well, vet for those. So who would call you out? Anyone who owns Shah horses?
Or? Oh, no. I'm vet for the society, and the biggest thing I do is the stallion licensing, because every February I do about 1,500 miles around the country, and I see the two-year-old stallions and the six-year-olds. And you know, my job, I suppose, is to make sure they haven't got hereditary diseases. So I think I must have examined about 650 stallions.
And do you look at the sort of the genetics of them these days, as opposed to just physically touching them?
You don't really. It is all done by all the big important things actually are visible, really. And there were some big genetic problems in Shire, but they've nearly all gone.
What were the problems?
Well, there was a joint problem, for example, which was really surprisingly common, and that's nearly gone.
It's brilliant, isn't it? So just by knowing and using the breeds and being careful.
Yeah. I mean, the Shire breed is numerically very big. At the breed show every year, there are 300 entries, which is more than there are Suffolks in existence, I suppose. So it's a completely different world. And they're worth a lot of money. And there are people who, you know, Shires are their living. You know, so it is a different world, really.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the Redpoll cattle is a nice sort of reddy, browny sort of colour, and the horse, the Suffolk horse, is a not quite the same colour, but that's reddish colour as well, isn't it? I wonder if that's coincidence.
I don't know about that, really.
We have to do some research into it as well. Yeah. And are you an examiner of the Worshipful Company of Farriers? So these are people who do all the shoeing of horses and so on.
Well, what happened with the Worshipful Company of Farriers is a city livery company, which were the medieval trade unions, and they what they set out to do really was they looked after their members, but they also governed quality of work as well, which was very important. And the Worshipful Company of Farriers, which was started in 1350, is still doing really what it set out to do, because it has the legal obligation really to run the qualifying exams for farriers. So farriers do a four-year apprenticeship, take a qualifying exam at the end of it. Now that's run by the Worshipful Company of Farriers, and then there are two higher exams. Which they run as well. And in the exam, you have two farriers who are examiners and a vet. There was a small veterinary part of it, so I became a veterinary examiner. And then, some or other, I became chairman of the examination board, which was all I needed, really. But it was a great honour, really, I suppose. My son, Ben, actually, he's become an examiner. That's not nepotism. He actually grew up with Roger Clark, who is one of the leading farriers in Great Britain, probably. So he became an examiner. And I mean, I'm clearly not a farrier. When I was made chairman, I came out of this meeting where it was decided I'd be the chairman, and there was a group of people, and one of them very properly said, well, what the hell do you know about it anyway? And my son said, oh, well, he said, you needn't worry about that. He's never let sheer ignorance of a subject hinder him in the past.
Have you owned horses and still ridden them through your life? I mean, do you still?
Well, I've had Suffolk horses for the last...
How many have you got?
Well, only one retired one now, but I showed them for 30 years, I suppose.
Yeah. So which was your...
Well, I've got Redpots as well, actually.
Have you as well?
And rare poultry.
Which, have you got an Ixworth and White, aren't they?
No.
They're quite pretty.
We have them at the Trust.
Do you as well?
Yeah.
So you're never going to retire, really, are you, basically?
I'd love to be absolutely really bored.
No, you wouldn't.
I would.
No, you wouldn't. So what are your plans? You've got no regrets, obviously, about becoming a vet.
Your assistant, Sarah, asked me what are my plans for the future. I thought, well, my age, to survive, really.
You sound like my dad. You've got about 20 or 30 years, so what are you going to do with them?
There'll be something.
And just to make sure the Suffolk Punch continues and...
Yes, I mean, that is so important, really.
Yeah. So anyone that wants to come along, the study's open through till...
Yeah, till the end of September, it's every day bar Tuesday. In October, it's Friday to Monday, so the long weekend. And on the last day, which is November the 3rd, there's going to be a Halloween day and all sorts of jollifications.
And anyone who wants to volunteer, there's loads of different things you can do.
Everything. There's the admin stuff, guides, the animals, whatever.
You did have someone who used to do all the tack, didn't you? And I think you lost
her. Oh, she was fantastic, she retired.
And it's beautiful. It's all that leather work, the stuff that goes on the horses. So if you fancy going and helping with that, then I'm sure you'd be welcome with opened arms, would they not?
They would.
Thank you for coming in. It's been really interesting.